And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. Summer blockbuster season is in full swing, despite the fact that it's not even Memorial Day, and this is the week when a lot of you are out there seeing Star Trek Into Darkness. We'll catch up with Kirk and Spock and the fellas, and we'll talk about what happens when you find yourself in an unfamiliar landscape where you don't exactly know what's going on, and we are not talking about space. Then we'll turn our attention to one of American television's most durable institutions, Saturday Night Live. We'll contemplate what it does, what it doesn't do, and whether it will, in fact, last forever. And as always, we'll close with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I'm a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I'm the movies editor for NPR.org.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Well, I'm awfully happy to see all of you, as always. So we have all seen a little Star Trek.
We have.
We have delved into the world of outer space and, Trekked into darkness. Now, let's get a little bit of background on where we're coming from. I personally just recently watched my first episode ever of the old original Star Trek.
Wow. Yes, the original series.
Yeah, the original series. I have seen a few Next Generations. I don't think I've seen any of the movies prior to the 09, but I did see the 09 Star Trek that was also J.J. Abrams.
I have seen all of the movies. I saw Voyager and the Next Generation on bootleg VHS when I was living in Africa. And I've probably seen all of the original series at some point. Never in order, but...
Never in order.
I know, right?
All right, Glenn?
Seen it all. Everything. Every damn thing, except for several seasons of Enterprise, which,
nobody watched
even
that.
Even I could not do. Enterprise was the, I think, fourth and final ongoing series.
Stephen Thompson.
I've occasionally been Star Trek adjacent in various ways.
Okay.
My household when I was growing up had a cat named Tribble, which was a big, big, mangy, brown Persian, smelled horrible.
Sounds perfect.
I went to a lot of science fiction conventions with my parents, who definitely like Star Trek, but for whatever reason, I've retained very little of it, other than what is sort of floating around the pop culture atmosphere.
Okay.
I did not see the reboot, the first J.J. Abrams
reboot.
Mm-hmm. I vaguely remember seeing the first two Star Trek movies, but for the most part, I went in, I took my kids to the movies, and like in many ways, it was basically three ignorant children ages 9 to 12.
Yeah. Okay, so from that perspective, we'll start with you. How did you enjoy it?
I enjoyed it. I mean, J.J. Abrams is a very, very skilled director. It is a very skilled action movie, like a like sort of space-bound action movie that I can tell I will retain almost none of in about 6 months.
Okay.
And I'm finding that more and more just in general with a lot of action movies. As I mentioned with Iron Man 3, they kept referencing the Avengers, which I love, and yet I couldn't remember what they were talking about. So I enjoyed it, but felt more or less unmoved by it.
Okay. Trey, how about you?
It's interesting what Stephen said about not remembering what happened in the first one is very much my experience of the first J.J. Abrams movie. This one, I don't know, it's still fairly fresh for me, so a lot of the incident is still there in my mind, but I can see where it might go that way. I expected to enjoy the performance of one Benedict Cumberbatch. I did, rather.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that he did a really good job of kind of sinking his teeth into this uber villain that he's playing without wishing to go into spoiler territory. He's playing one of the series' iconic villains.
Sure.
And I thought he did a really good job of sort of grabbing hold of it and becoming part of that universe and, you know, playing a big, big character without stepping entirely away from technique, which I think he's got a lot of.
Okay.
So I enjoyed it.
Glenn, how about you?
We stepped out of this theater, my partner and I, and we both said the same thing. That felt like an episode of the series. The difference is he meant it as damning criticism because he didn't like the series, and I meant it as exactly, yes, this is exactly what I wanted from this movie. I think after the first reboot, the J.J. Abrams 2009 Star Trek, that was big and splashy, but now we need to kind of get these people on the road. We need to actually have them Trek a little bit. So it felt like they need to get down to business. Abrams himself in interviews has said the first film was about getting them on the bridge. The second film was about making it seem like they really deserve to be there.
Mm-hmm.
Not sure if that worked for me, but I certainly feel like he understands the basic dynamic of this series. And I also think it was palpable to me that at least in this movie, he's kind of thinking, and the screenwriters are thinking, that the heat is really more with the Spock character than the Kirk character.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a theory on why that might be. I think Kirk is a hot-headed rebel who doesn't play by the rules. McBain! You know,
yeah.
And that is a trope
right.
that we have seen in every action film
right.
for a long time. There is one area, one science fiction trope that the Star Trek films franchise series has a certain amount of ownership of. This one piece of narrative real estate that they kind of own, at least in the public imagination, and that is this question of what is it to be human?
Mm-hmm.
For every single iteration of the Trek brand has had some character who's struggling with what it means to be human,
mm-hmm.
struggling with feelings. It's Data and Odo and mm-hmm. Spock and all these, that struggle, which is, let's agree, kind of a cheesy struggle because it usually comes down to emotions and a single Vulcan tear.
I can't believe that you've not mentioned Seven of Nine.
Well, I did. Okay, so it's all part of that same trope, yep. which admittedly leads you to a place where there's a Vulcan tear, which if it's not Pon Farr, there should not be a Vulcan tear. I'll just say but I do think that is what has led over and over again to those speeches in the original series. We humans need love, need feeling. And that is the cheesiness that
I'm just going to drop out of this conversation entirely right. and just let you do character.
No, just have yeah. Glenn do Shatner.
Do you have a German Kirk?
I don't. But that is the cheesiness that hardcore fans will deny is there
right.
and that fans like me will embrace
right.
because you got to kind of embrace it.
Okay, now I actually have seen a couple of complaints. Not even complaints. I've seen essays saying that this movie still feels too much like setup and not enough like an episode of the series. That it's using characters like McCoy and Chekhov as comic relief, as support, not driving plot lines, that it's not grappling with the existential questions and it's not dealing with the moral questions.
I think that's right, but I would say one thing, and I was just terribly proud of myself when I mean, I didn't see the 09 Star Trek originally. I saw it just recently in preparation for this coming out. And when I saw it, I thought, I have learned from Glenn Weldon, because the minute that I was seeing the beginning of the 09 Star Trek, when they show Kirk's father, right, putting him in the thing and sending him off, and the mother is in labor and all this stuff is happening, and then they actually put him on it and send him off as the planet is I thought, that's a superhero origin story.
Yes,
that's
mm-hmm.
all that is a superhero origin story.
It might as well be the opening sequence of Superman.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Except shorter. And when and when I mentioned that on Twitter, there were a couple people who said to me, yeah, you know, there's a lot of this kind of monomyth mm-hmm. stuff.
There you go. Oh,
In this particular, Glenn's like, oh, yeah, I'm getting
Let me check my watch.
No.
What time was it?
There's a lot of this hero's journey stuff that we have talked about when you look at it. There are a bunch of these elements, and it's very much a Kirk story.
Mm-hmm.
This is much more a Spock story, mm-hmm. and it's a Spock story. I mean, I think one of the reasons why they feel, I think you're correct, that the heat is with the Spock character, is that these movies do rely pretty heavily on comedy. And I think the kind of comedy that they do with Kirk is, like you say, it's very kind of, you know, Mel Gibson in Lethal Weapon.
Right.
It's like, it's not that different. Whereas the Spock comedy, both because the Zachary Quinto performance is unusual and interesting, and
yeah.
they're still feeling out who this Spock particularly is.
Mm-hmm.
And what his limits are and what he does, they've got some really nice comedy beats with him. So I think to me, it was satisfying. But that's, you know, that's me coming from where I'm coming from.
Yeah.
But I definitely felt like it was less set up than the first one, which felt exactly like an origin story, a first superhero movie.
Right. Now, I have a question for both you and Steven that gets to what we wanted to talk about and widen that a little bit, which is how you, coming to this particular film, which plays with plot elements of one of the previous Star Trek films, in fact, directly inverts them.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know that until later. I looked it up on Wikipedia.
Exactly. So, for example, you know, the climax of this movie, for better or for worse, is Spock running around and having a fistfight, which is the Kirk thing. That mm-hmm. is Kirk's milieu.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that we now, you know, you just watch that scene and you can hear in your head, bah, 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 bah. I'm a guy who reads a lot of science fiction and reads a lot of superhero comics. So I'm used to this whole parallel universe thing and how these two realities kind of bounce off each other, and how what that does in, say, superhero comics is it gives you this idea of like, okay, here's the character, the iconic character, and here's all these views of him or her. It kind of makes the world around them seem deeper and richer. Here, I just got novelty.
Right. It's important to understand that what's happening in these Abrams films is that an alternative timeline has been established. So what happens here is not canonical in the original. Right.
It's important to you to understand. No, I'm not saying that. That's not a dig. What I'm saying is
important is relevant.
I'm not. Like I said, it's not a dig. That came out harsher than I meant it. What I'm saying is, if you come at this trying to figure out how it fits into the big Star Trek universe, then it is important.
Sure.
But if you're coming to this fresh, if for example, this whole universe to you is the J.J. Abrams, right? The 2009.
Oh, sure. No, I certainly didn't mean to imply that newcomers need to go do all this
homework. That's what I mean.
It's perfectly enjoyable without
you can have, to me, what I like about this kind of movie and this, again, this, you can have the same conversation about Star Wars or any right. one of a number of things, is that there are kind of a variety of ways to look at it that are valid. And I think that there are often these questions of, depending on how much information you have, something strikes you differently than it otherwise would. I was talking to somebody today about the fact that I think I would have liked the Gatsby movie a lot better if I didn't know the book.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So if you don't know how far it's wandering from what the point of the book is supposed to be, do you like it more?
Right. Because that's my question, because those in-jokes are things that I got and Trey got probably a lot of. It felt to me like a lot of the engine of this movie was it's the way it kind of touched on and played off of the stuff from a previous Star Trek mm-hmm. film. So I'm wondering what it felt like to you guys.
I got a sense of that, in part because we were sitting in a theater full of people and there were certain moments. Now, there are certain moments that are referencing things where I know the reference.
Right.
And I'm able to sort of chuckle along, like, right. oh, I know they're hitting a point in the history of the show here. But there were also moments in the movie where the audience would just mysteriously start laughing.
Yeah.
yeah. And I would have, frankly, no idea.
I had that experience once or twice.
Not a lot.
Right.
But
I would draw the line between everybody knows I'm a doctor, not a whatever, right?
Sure.
Everybody knows that one.
And at least 3/4 of the audience probably knows why it's funny when Kirk tells Chekhov to go put on a red shirt.
Yes, absolutely. But the one that it took me a second, when McCoy was doing the business about the endless metaphors, people started chuckling. And I thought those were funny, but I mean, I thought they were good lines and, you know, but I wasn't sure why they were funny until he said the thing about stop talking in metaphors or
right.
whatever it was. And then I realized, oh, this is the thing he always does. And that's why they're all laughing.
Yes, right.
So then I got it. But
and then there's the particular breed of nerd who's going to go, ooh, when they get to that one particular death scene and the one particular hand and the camera angle.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And I, like
nerd
I said,
is
I,
not me.
Like I said, I looked this all up later on Wikipedia. But to speak about the kind of nerd that Steven is, I think the most logical connection to this for me, interestingly enough, is the fact they're about to show a bunch more episodes of Arrested Development.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I will tie this to something else still, which is that, as you guys probably know, and as I know Trey knows, NPR, the apps team at NPR recently published a hilariously detailed, obsessive, I'm going to say slightly crazy, visualization of recurring jokes on Arrested Development. One of the things that it indicates is that the farther that show went, the denser it was
right.
with back references and cross references. And my question to Steven is, is there any possibility that you could come in? Now, we can't know this for sure because we don't know what they're going to look like.
Right.
But does it seem at all plausible that you could come in as sort of stranger in a strange land to new episodes of Arrested Development and have that show make any sense to you?
You know, that's a great question. And obviously, I can't separate out my anticipation. You know, my anticipation for these new episodes of Arrested Development, it's entirely based on the fact that I've seen every episode of Arrested Development umpteen times. I'm assuming, given the way that show is structured, where it has a lot of built-in narration, I'm guessing that in the first episode, you're probably going to have Ron Howard walking you somewhat through the history of the show to at least identify who the characters are. Even in any given episode of Arrested Development, the way they do the opening credits mm-hmm. is to establish the story of the show, to give newbies at least a chance to get a sense of who people are. So I'm assuming that it's not going to be so up its own nose that people aren't going to be able to follow it at all. I'm sure at the same time that you're going to have a mixture of broad comedy and these kind of callback to a callback to a callback that, you know, you're not necessarily going to need Adam Cole's amazing app to follow any given episode. And I certainly enjoyed, and to a certain extent, my kids enjoyed Star Trek Into Darkness, even though, especially in my kids' case, they had no idea who anybody was.
Yeah.
And the kids, you know, the kids' knowledge of Star Trek is going to be entirely filtered through parodies and references.
Right.
I mean, Futurama.
They watch so much Simpsons that they...
Yeah, they watch everything. Like, everything that they... Every view of pop culture they have is almost through the lens of The Simpsons.
Right.
But Star Trek in particular, they see through the lens of Futurama,
right,
which referenced it a lot.
Right.
And so I think they're able, just through sort of steeping in the petri dish of popular culture, are going to have a sense of the movies. I did find it interesting, just sort of as an aside, that Benedict Cumberbatch, you know, whom Trey mentioned earlier, was almost an in-joke in and of himself to people in the crowd. Like, Benedict Cumberbatch, in a sense, is almost... I mean, I think he's great in it. I think he's a terrific actor. But he's almost so fetishized, I think, by...
As a performer,
but also as a good-looking dude, and as a good, you know, as a good actor who's been in a million things that people love.
But, yeah, but for a guy who's mostly famous for being on, in this country... like PBS.
Sherlock on PBS, right? Yeah.
It's remarkable how the reveal of him was like you would reveal George Clooney near the end of ER. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, it is remarkable how...
When his name popped up in the closing credits, the woman
And that's probably knowing your audience. Yeah.
Right. When his name popped up in the closing credits, the woman down the aisle from me kind of did the... You know, at the... Just the excitement level that Benedict Cumberbatch had been in this movie.
Well, also, they're checking some boxes here. You got RoboCop versus Sherlock on the bridge of the Enterprise. I mean, come on.
It's true.
Slash fic gone awry.
It's true. Well, and there was... The other thing that was funny to me about him is that there was somebody on Twitter, and I apologize for not remembering who it was, but there's somebody on Twitter who said, I think somebody's got a badass duster clause in his contract. Because when he's got anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, I actually want to bring up one other fictional universe in this conversation, which is a massive change of direction, but absolutely appropriate to this week. I recently saw Before Midnight, which is the third in the Before Sunset, Before Sunrise.
See, and I just watched Before Sunrise.
Mm-hmm.
And it will be opening in a limited number of theaters this very day as you hear this.
I believe, you know, Before Midnight and Before Sunset and Before Sunrise are all on their own lovely movies. I think you could see any of them without seeing the other ones, and they would still be lovely movies. But... it is when you take those three movies together that they become genuinely to me, and I don't use this word lightly, something of a masterpiece.
Hmm.
Because when you have seen all three of them, I think you look back on the first one and you say, that could never have been anything except the first movie in this set of three movies. Which is so funny because for many years, that was just
a very good standalone.
People loved it. They had lovely feelings about it. And I remember when they announced that there was going to be a sequel to it, and everybody sort of went, oh, my God, we're going to find out whether these people ever saw each other again. Which you assumed, after you saw the first one, that you wouldn't. So they can stand on their own, but there is an entire level of work going on in those movies that only works. They all get better after you've seen all three of them. Even the first one, which I loved. Mm-hmm. I saw that movie a gazillion times. Even the first one is a richer, better movie after you see these three, and then you think, you know, because it works like life in that it's very powerful as an experience when it first happens. But then you also get a view of it in light of...
It gets richer.
And when you look back on it, it looks both the same and different. And you realize...
It's recontextualized a million times over.
Absolutely. If I'd known then what I know now. So, yes, this is my connection between the Star Trek universe and the Jesse and Celine universe.
Well, okay. Well, one point that I wanted to make about Star Trek, and you know, it somewhat ties into that, is clearly it is a richer experience the more Star Trek nerdery you have kind of piled atop itself. I also think it can get away with bending the rules of that universe a little bit more because there have been so many iterations of this show. Linda mentioned earlier the idea of rebooting Star Wars and how incredible, what total sacrilege, well, I mean, there were the prequels, which were sacrilege in and of themselves,
sure.
But that's a sort of singular vision.
Right.
Star Trek, you had the original series with William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy, and then you had these movies, which are of wildly varying quality, and then you have Enterprise over here, and you have sort of different windows into that world that span generations and eras and actors and directors
and styles.
And, you know, even whole quadrants of that universe that people never, you know, sort of conceived of in the original series. I mean, the one that we haven't mentioned at all is Deep Space Nine, which is, you know, this sort of very marginal piece of that universe.
Right.
Well, I wouldn't go that far. I would say it's a much darker vision of that universe, but it's a very good version of the universe.
But I think that these films, these Abrams films, do probably have a little bit more leeway than some of these franchises, because there's been so much of it from so many different people.
Right. But we were talking earlier about this idea of parallel universes and how these different interpretations, these different iterations affect each other. I mean, that's been done in the Star Trek universe before in Generations, when we have Captain Picard meet Captain Kirk. And that did feel like fanboy, fangirl, you know, explosion. That was awesome.
RoboCop fighting Sherlock.
Exactly. Wasn't a particularly great movie, but it didn't matter because it was awesome.
Gene Kelly and Fred Astaire only danced together in one movie.
See, right there. But see, my point earlier was that I think I didn't feel that this film enriched anything. When young Spock phones a friend in this film, it felt like a cop-out to me. It felt like it was thinning this universe as opposed to enriching it. And it just felt like, don't do that. I mean, they put that scene in there because you'd be wondering in your seat. I would be wondering in my seat, how come he didn't call Fiverr?
Yeah.
It also felt loving as an outsider.
Yeah,
it felt,
I think,
like
that's
a,
the
it felt like a tribute as much as anything.
Yeah, but that's the line that these things have to walk. That's what Arrested Development's going to have to walk. And that's, to a certain extent, that's what the Beyond Sunrise, whatever they are called. I've never seen them. But because they got feelings. It's the same reason they didn't like this film. But to a certain extent, they have to walk that line of not going into fan service.
Speaking of feelings and such like, and Glenn not liking it, before we abandon the topic of Star Trek entirely, I did want to point out, we've talked a bit about this being sort of tilted towards Spock. I actually thought Chris Pine was doing some nice work in this. He gets to do a little bit of acting.
One would hope.
Well, and there is an emotional thread for Kirk to follow in this movie.
Right.
It's very much about his sort of coming to terms with absent father business.
Yeah.
Right. And this is sort of, whereas if the other one was a superhero origin story, this to me is kind of a crucible story because of the way it starts.
Yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm.
And it starts with sort of a, you know, you have the giant setback and then you have to earn your wings again, essentially. So, but I enjoyed it. And I encourage all of you to come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/PCHH and tell us what you thought about this movie or anything else that has, you know, multiple iterations, finding yourself a stranger in a strange universe of that you don't maybe completely understand. So speaking of strange things we don't completely understand, this week was the send-off for Bill Hader and Fred Armisen and maybe Jason Sudeikis, they haven't said for sure, on Saturday Night Live. And as they have been doing for the last few years, they did little, you know, sketches to say goodbye to these guys. They did a Stefan sketch for Hader. They did a band playing sketch for Fred Armisen that Carrie Brownstein appeared in and a bunch of other people. So we thought this would be a good week to check in briefly on the state of the union over on Saturday Night Live. You know, one of the things that I always find interesting about that show is that it used to serve a very specific function that I'm not sure it still serves. And I'm curious what you guys think, because I feel like its launching of comedy careers is now shared with a bunch of other things on cable, things online. And I'm just curious what you think. How about you, Glenn?
Well, it struck me that there are a bunch of different things that the show does. There's always the cold open, the political stuff, which historically has been sort of broad and I would say toothless. It's not exactly biting satire. Then there's the engine of the show is the catchphrases, the impressions, and the parodies, the game show parodies especially. And that is what produces a lot of recurring characters, a lot of catchphrases, and that's the stuff that I find a little less than interesting. Update is its own thing.
Yeah.
Update tends to be much sharper, in my opinion. It tends to be a little bit more.
It's got
a, it's got a more distinct voice. It's got
it's
a uniform voice. And then finally, at the end of the night is the time that I really love, because that right after the second musical interlude,
you were maybe the first person ever to say this.
No. And 1 o'clock is this thing where they dump the weird stuff. And the weird stuff historically has this, it's either, you can call it absurdist or you can call it anti-comedy or sometimes just not plain funny.
Yeah. Right.
But it's always interesting and sometimes baffling. And that's not what I get from the show. This show is so pitched to the mainstream now. It's become such an institution that it's got that little sliver of time at the very end of the night for things to get weird. So that's, as far as if it still launches people, I mean, Kristen Wiig is going to go on to huge things. She put in her time there. That's certainly true. I do think that certain people like Fred Armisen is much better served by Portlandia than SNL, in my opinion. I think Portlandia plays to his strengths, and we'll talk about what being live still adds to the show, if anything. I think it might be time to make it Saturday night recorded, but we'll talk about it a little
bit.
Well, but Linda used a word in the previous segment that I think still jumps out about this show, which is crucible. This show is a test for young comedy talent. I mean, young comedy talent that has clearly cleared a bunch of hurdles to get on the show and then sort of proves its mettle in the moment with all the challenges of live performance in ways that sitcoms aren't going to test them. And I do think it's clearly still a gigantic launchpad for a lot of very, very talented people. I think that naturally, you know, Saturday Night Live as a comedy institution, I've been hearing about its inevitable demise for 30 years now. You know, where, oh, it used to be great and now it's terrible. It used to be great. And any institution, particularly for whatever reason, comedy institutions go through that from like day two. You know, day two, they're not as funny as they were on day one. And I think the fact that, you know, I generally do not watch Saturday Night Live. I just, for whatever reason, I've never, it's never really entered my habits. You know, I go back and watch episodes if I hear they're really good. And I went back and watched this episode from last Saturday night. And I felt, you know, obviously it's uneven, but boy, I laughed a bunch of times. It's a lot funnier than it's been through any number of fallow periods. And I think the fact that when these things reach a point where they're an institution in such a way that they really needn't ever go away, I think that clearly Saturday Night Live is going to suck horribly, and then it's going to be good, and then it's going to suck horribly, and then it's going to be mediocre, and then it's going to suck again, and then it's going to be good again.
Yeah, it goes through.
I'll just be curious to see. Now, let me just be frank here. You talked about this as an institution, and this is a universe all its own, and strangers in a strange land. I am that stranger. This is a universe that I do not grok. I'd have no idea who that person was who walked on stage in the Five t-shirt talking to Ben Affleck in this episode, which I watched on Hulu.
But he was just a funny goof. You didn't need to know.
I will say that my sense of this institution is that it is one that has been shaped and molded to fit the shape of one Lorne Michaels.
Right.
And it is the case with all institutions that they go through a terrible, dangerous transition period when their founder moves on. Now, at whatever point Lorne Michaels decides to move on, Saturday Night Live will necessarily face a huge transition, an inflection point, right?
I think that's a very fair point.
Well, it has. I mean, he has left the show, replaced by Dick Ebersole in the benighted 80s, which is when I started watching the show as a young teenager. So this is the Gary Kroger, the timeless names, like Gary Kroger and Brad
Hall.
Tim Kazurinsky.
And a young lady by the name of Julia Louis-Dreyfus, I don't think anybody ever heard of ever again.
That was an era that was watched over, at least in part, by the guy Michael O'Donohue, who was known as Mr. Mike. And the book, Live from New York, Tom Shale's book, is a history of this period, of the entire show. And he talks about how when Michael O'Donohue came in, he started screaming at people, telling them that they weren't funny. And Catherine O'Hara, who was going to be on the show, said, I don't want to be any part of this, and left. Now, when you lose Catherine O'Hara, Catherine O'Hara is a national treasure.
Yeah.
Like, admittedly, Canadian.
Canadian treasure. Yes.
But I mean, like, any... something.
We love you, Canada. I'm only kidding.
Something is wrong with a show if it's going to lose Catherine O'Hara.
Well, and that show has, obviously, without rehashing this entire thing, that show has a well-known, long-standing problem with women.
Yes.
Problem with giving opportunities to women, I would say especially women of color. For the most part, black women on that show are played by black men.
Yeah.
That has been historically true.
Well,
there are exceptions.
And all black men are played by one black guy.
Well, well exactly. But there have been exceptions. There was Ellen Cleghorn and a couple other people. But that show has a very limited history of giving good opportunities to women. Now, there have been periods where the women were the ones who were massively the most popular
and
most
and
important.
Amy Poehler,
The Tina Fey and Amy Poehler period, the
Sherry
Kristen,
O'Terry.
To some degree, the Kristen Wiig and Maya Rudolph period, the Sherry O'Terry and Molly Shannon and Anna Gasteyer period. They have managed to make a name for themselves, but that show has also really not done well by some really talented women, including Casey Wilson, who we talked about last week, who they never figured out what to do with her. And then she went off and she's wonderfully funny on Happy Endings and other things. You know, Jenny Slate, who got fired shortly after, she was the one who dropped an F-bomb on TV. I don't think that's why. But so they have a long and difficult and unhappy history with women. And I, you know, I think that has gotten better in some ways.
Sure.
But it's still complicated.
If you look at the repertory players and the featured players, it's still, there's 5 women out of the 14 total, and 2 out of the 10 repertory players are women. That's and what's happening now with these 4, you know, Seth Meyers is going to be leaving in midway through the season, too.
Right.
So that's 3.5 people who are leaving all at once. That's going to rejigger the things and maybe make that some of the other men can kind of step up in the way that I think certainly Kate McKinnon and Cecily Strong have stepped up in the absence of Kristen Wiig.
The thing that Cecily Strong and Vanessa Bayer did this weekend with the handbags.
Decadence. Extravagance. Sophistication. Sumptuousness. The finest. Herman's handbags.
Yeah, that's
I just find so weird and funny and just it's so bizarre. So they play these 2 former adult film actresses who are now trying to sell handbags, and there's this moment where one of them says, "What do you call it? The thing that you put your money in when you go out?" And she says, "Mailbox."
No, but like when you want to walk around with it.
Jar.
A wallet.
Oh, yeah, a wallet.
Yeah.
And they're just so weird.
The thing that's about that sketch, again, it's SNL, so that sketch has recurred in various different iterations. It's as much about the jokes, because the joke's hit or miss, the tone. There's something about their locution, the way they nail. It's the same way that Cecily Strong nails the girl you wish you hadn't started a conversation with at a party. There's something about that inflection.
Yeah.
There's something very, very true about this. Now, I want to say one thing real quick, which is that this notion, we've talked about how the show has gone up and down. I would argue that this show, there has never been a golden age for this show. You think that the original time with the original Not Ready for Primetime Players was great. 90 minutes, people, is a long time.
Yeah, it is.
And if you go back and watch those original sketches, those original shows, it feels bloated. It always has. It always goes on too long. There's things that don't work. But that's kind of the deal. It's sketch comedy.
When you compare sketch comedies and you look at something like Portlandia versus Saturday Night Live, the single biggest advantage Portlandia has over Saturday Night Live is being one-third as long.
Yeah.
As much as I think that they do a great job on that show, I think that many sketch comedy shows have been really good. But the absolute best thing you can do for your sketch comedy show, this is one of the reasons why sketch comedy translates so well to Hulu and YouTube and other things like that, is that the hardest thing to do is to actually put together an entire hour and a half long show.
Well, and also, I remember I interviewed Bob Odenkirk years and years ago, and I was asking him about to sort of compare Mr. Show and Saturday Night Live, and the first thing he brought up was, you know, we're a third as long, we're pre-recorded, we don't have to make Wayne Gretzky funny.
Yeah, well, and that raises one of the other functions that I do think SNL still serves, which is, it is still a tremendous goodwill generator for certain kinds of celebrities.
Well, and for people who need to rehabilitate themselves.
Right, right.
But it's a validation engine, not only for the people it chooses as its, you know, guest hosts, but also for its musical acts. It's a sign of arrival. Yeah. I mean, the fact that Saturday Night's episode had Kanye West performing new material, you know, these, right. it is a launching point for big moments and big right. releases and a sign that a musical act or a host has sort of arrived.
Has kind of become relevant. And it's interesting because one of the bits that they've done involves hosts who are joining what they call the Five Timers Club. And the first time that they did the Five Timers Club, there were only a handful of guys in it. It was like Steve Martin, Paul Simon, and Tom Hanks, and a couple other guys. Mm-hmm. Now there's a whole bunch of guys in that club, right. including most recently, Ben Affleck. Now, I like Ben Affleck, but do I think of Ben Affleck as like a classic host of Saturday Night mm-hmm. Live? I don't really. But there are people like Alec Baldwin, for example, mm-hmm. for whom Saturday Night Live, and specifically hosting Saturday mm-hmm. Night Live, not being a cast member, just hosting, was enormously important to what happened to Alec Baldwin. It was enormously yeah. important to what happened to Justin Timberlake.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it still is, if you find the right host and they're unexpectedly good, it can really make people look at a performer differently.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you what you think, you all, of the cachet of the live show and how what that means is we're going to get a consummate performer, a guy who's great at it like Alec Baldwin reading cue cards. We're going to get people flubbing their lines. And, you know, however funny you may think it is when Jimmy Fallon breaks. I just, of live from New York at Saturday night, the thing that matters least to me is the live bit.
Yeah.
I like it being in front of an audience. It needs to be.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I just don't feel this electric charge of this is happening right now.
I don't know.
And I don't think I'd miss it.
I don't know.
Any thoughts?
I would agree with that. I mean, I'm sure it's part of, it's so wired into the DNA
right.
of the show that you have these, you have occasional moments, not only of people cracking up, which, you know, it goes through the whole history of that show, mm-hmm. but the sense of, you know, there could be an F-bomb dropped.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's like why some people watch NASCAR. Like, there might be a crash.
I was going right. to say, you say that you don't miss that frisson until there's a train wreck, and then that's what everybody's going to talk about for the next 3 days.
I think it's part of the energy. I'm not really sure. I'm not really sure if I'd miss it.
For me, I would rather see a really well-put-together digital short or parody commercial or something like that. It just feels more contained. It feels more polished.
I do tend to find their pre-recorded stuff the funniest.
Right. Yeah. I think there's some the pre-recorded stuff and Update.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and certainly if you look at Update recently, you know, Tina Fey, Jimmy Fallon, mm-hmm. now Seth Meyers, who's going to take Jimmy Fallon's show, and Jimmy Fallon takes Jay Leno's show. Certainly Update has been the most, and Amy Poehler too,
sure.
has been the most effective launching pad that show has had in
That's
recent
true.
Years. But anyway. All right. Well, we should get on to our final segment, which is what is making us happy this week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
On Friday night, I had my dear pal Linda Holmes over to my house to watch TV. Now, in my house with my kids, Friday night is movie night. And while scrolling through the Roku menu...
Oh, look at you.
I know. I'm one with technology. I hit the movie Top Gun. And I have to, and I admit to Linda, I've never seen Top Gun.
Wow. Okay.
And then we're flipping and we're flipping and we're flipping. And we get to Footloose.
Whoa.
And I have to acknowledge, I had never seen Footloose. Now, this is the downside of the parents who try to give
right.
their kids a wonderful, well-rounded cultural education. You wind up skipping the thing that will actually be relevant to their youth.
Well,
while I was watching Midnight Cowboy
and Rashomon and the 400 Blows,
Rashomon and the 39 Steps, reading a lot of Donald Duck, I did not see Flashdance, I did not see Footloose, I did not see Top Gun, and I did not see Dirty Dancing.
We're going to work through it.
We're going to work through it. I'm catching up on the canon, as it were. And on Friday night, sat down with the kids and watched Footloose, which I felt like I had seen through marinating in Kenny Loggins videos for as much as I did. I did enjoy the fact that the one non-iconic song on the Footloose soundtrack is the scene that Kenny Loggins' Footloose video is set to, where he's doing the gymnastics routine in the flower factory or whatever. So I finally, and I'm here to report, you know, only what was it, been 30 years now? 30 years late, I have finally seen Footloose, and it's a pretty good movie. There's some terrific acting in Footloose. John Lithgow is terrific.
John Lithgow's terrific in that movie.
I know.
John Lithgow is actually, he's moving in Footloose.
Yeah, it's true. But the best part of that viewing experience, you have to admit, is that Stephen and I got talking about the ballads that dominated movies of the 80s.
Love theme from blank.
Love theme from blank. Uh-huh.
Which parentheses.
Right. And we were trying to remember, like, what was the pair of people who he got very animated
Peebo
when we were
who?
Trying to remember.
Peebo Bryson and?
Yeah. Well, Stephen got very animated when we were trying to remember which song Peter Cetera did with Amy Grant. This is the kind of thing we do on a Friday night.
Yeah, except I'm talking about, like, you know, you have your love theme from Tequila Sunrise, which is with Robin Zander from Cheap Trick, not, you know, not Mike Reno from Loverboy. Yeah. No, that's all, you know. Ugh. But we could not get After All, which is Peter Cetera with
Cher.
With Cher from the movie Chances Are.
Yeah.
Anyway, so yeah, we went down this whole rabbit hole of me imitating Peter Cetera in like nine different songs.
We're singing a lot.
Oh, it was, you know, Friday night, you know, while other kids with their, as Glenn would say, their raccoon coats and their,
rumble seats
and packing into phone
booths. This is what we were doing.
We were watching Footloose.
Just circle back to the beginning of the story and the Roku and the, you know, looking at Top Gun? I was hoping that was the one you were going to tell me you'd watch.
Next.
Because we needed to discuss the
I will report back.
You know, the locker room scene.
We'll do it.
I will report back. You
could have gone 30 more years without seeing Footloose.
No.
Should have stayed strong.
I insisted.
No, I'm not one of those people. I don't like it when people stubbornly embrace their ignorance or stubbornly embrace their I've never owned a TV. That, you know, that's not me, man. I want to see the things that people see.
All right, Trey Graham, what's making you happy this week?
At movie night in my house, which is Thursday night, I watched, finally, Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs.
Oh, that movie's so fun!
Which is completely charming and has many, many funny jokes that recur. By the end of it, as I said on the Twitter at the time, every appearance of the Ratbirds had me, you know, giggling like a loon. That is not what's making me happy this week.
But that movie is great.
That movie is delightful.
Get it. With a Chance of Meatballs.
Rent it. Watch it. I believe there's a sequel coming out this summer, so enjoy that. What's making me happy this week? The writer and radio essayist, David Rakoff, died less than a year ago. And there was something of an outpouring of grief and remembrance at the time. Among other things, Terry Gross said the words I and me what must be a record number of times in the hour-long program that they devoted to remembering him. He's got a book coming out, posthumously. His final book, supposedly, although you never really know about these things, it is certainly his first novel. And it was mentioned in some of the coverage of his death, I think, but I missed it at the time, so this is new news to me and welcome news. It is called Love, Dishonor, Marry, Die, Cherish, Perish. And it is a novel in verse. There's a trailer now on YouTube. If it was up earlier than yesterday, I missed that too.
Sure.
But the one I looked at, the one I discovered today was posted yesterday and had not had many views. There are all manner of luminaries from Calvin Trillin to Jackie Hoffman to Ira Glass reading an excerpt from this book. And here is a bit of it. It's about a guy giving a toast at the wedding of his ex-wife and his best friend. And this guy tells that famous story about the scorpion who convinces the tortoise to give him a ride across the river.
The room had grown frosty. The tension was growing. Folks wondered precisely where Nathan was going.
The prospects of skirting fiasco seemed dim, but what he said next surprised even him.
So what can we learn from their watery ends? Is there some lesson on how to be friends? I think what it means is that central to living, a life that is good, is a life that's forgiving.
And at the end, there's a moment where David Rakoff himself turns up, sitting in a studio, much like the one we're in right now with headphones on, to read the punchline to that wedding toast story. And the punchline is funny and a little dark and very much wise-ass, as you might expect from this guy. And that story and that trailer and the news of that novel, which will be out in, I think, July, all of those things are collectively what's making me happy this week.
Wonderful. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
A couple things. Patton Oswalt improvised a filibuster for an episode of Parks and Recreation. He plays a guy who wants to filibuster the city council. And in this filibuster, he marries the universes of Star Wars with the Marvel Universe. It is beyond...
With a bunch of other stuff.
With a bunch of other things. It is beyond genius. And of course, as is inevitable, as day follows night, it has been animated in a very funny series of clips. So it's worth checking out. The thing that's making me happy is a book by Dash Shaw. Dash Shaw is a graphic novelist. This book is called New School. I just reviewed it for NPR. It won't be up on the site for a while, though, because I think the book's been delayed a little bit, maybe to July. He belongs to a group of, well, the category I guess you would call, even though I hate this term, art comics. These are people like Jim Woodring, Charles Burns, Jesse Jacobs, Kolbein Carlson. It's exactly what it sounds like. So instead of a tidy narrative, these books are about art. They're about the art that's in the book itself. I've talked before, I think on this show and also on the blog, about how I've been reading a lot of graphic novels lately that feel very schematic, feel very tidy. They shut at the end with a kind of a snap. And it's kind of like reading nothing but genre fiction. After a while, you want to be surprised. You want a book to take you someplace you haven't figured out where it is. And this book is just fascinating. It's huge, and each page looks like it's been scrawled freehand using a Sharpie, but it hasn't. It's very, very tightly composed. And then every so often, it's a young narrator, so when at these moments of intense emotion, he just slaps this solid block of color over the page that goes across the lines, so it doesn't line up exactly. And then as the narrator ages into adolescence, all of a sudden this thing gets saturated with all these different colors and patterns that kind of overlay the events that he's talking about. And you start to think, is there some kind of code here? Does yellow mean X and blue mean Y? But what I really love about this this book is that it's working. It's telling a story, but it's also, there's stuff going on underneath it at an intuitive level, the level of the unconscious, the level of the subconscious, I guess you'd say. And it builds to this giant climactic ending where every page is just one illustration saturated with color. And what he's doing there is very, very smart. He's making you slow down. Now, if you're not used to reading graphic novels, you're going to see something like that, and you're just going to page real quickly. But he's like sending every signal he possibly can to tell you, slow down, something is happening here. Now, when I reviewed the book, I said something like, the meaning does not surrender itself upon first reading, which is my way of saying, I'm not sure I get it.
Yeah.
But I love that feeling. I know that it's there. And I keep going back to this book to kind of re-explore it and try to make these intuitive connections that he's making. It is, you know, okay, this book is smarter than me. Let me just come out and say it. But I feel like reaching for something. I want to do the work that this book requires of me. So I really, really love it. It's ambiguity without obtuseness, if that makes any sense. He's letting me make connections. He's not tying everything up in a bow. But I'm prepared to do this work, and you should be too, because it's great. It's called New School by Dash Shaw.
Wonderful. Thank you, Glenn. Well, the first thing that was making me happy, of course, was watching Footloose and singing some 80s ballads. I would also mention that as we tape this today, it is the birthday of our dear pal, Margaret H. Willison, who is far too young. But, you know, we forgive her for that. And then the other thing making me happy this week is that we did not talk very much last week about the finale of The Office, which was on Thursday night. As we taped this on Monday, it was on Thursday. And, you know, for me, this is a show I have had I definitely fell out of love with a little bit as it got later on, but I continued to watch it. And the first five or six seasons of that show, particularly the first three or four, I have watched a tremendous number of times. They stream on Netflix, and that's one of the things I watch at night when I'm going to sleep. So this is a show I have a pretty close and tight bond with, viewer-wise. And for me, the finale did a lot more subtle work than it kind of got credit for. Parts of it are so warm and so lovely that I think it got a little overlooked that there are also some very sad endings in that finale, depending on how you think about it. So for me, it was very satisfying. I also got to be right about something I had predicted on Twitter. I'm just saying. And I really enjoyed it, and it meant a lot to me. And to me, closing out a show like that well goes a long way toward making me mind less if you have had a rough few seasons at the end of the run. Right. So when it's good and I like the ending and I like what you did to give the characters a farewell that I can work with, it goes a long way. I am hoping the same thing will happen next year with How I Met Your Mother. Because that's got some ground to make up with May as well. So that is what is making me happy this week.
See, now, Linda, I have to say, I assumed that one of the things making you happy was going to be Downton Abbey with farts.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was on previously.tv, which we talked about last week.
God.
But Downton Abbey with farts, also very funny. Also very funny. But anyway, that is our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham, Trey with an E.
Trey's laughing about Downton Abbey with farts.
I still am.
Trey with an E, Graham like the cracker. You can follow Glenn at G-H Weldon, W-E-L-D-O-N. You can follow our producer, Jess Gittner, at Jess Gittner, G-I-T-N-E-R. You can follow our esteemed producer, emeritus, and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week.